Good afternoon. This program is Live and Local. It's your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. On the program today, coming up, we will talk with and hear from tubist Mark Moore, who is the faculty tubist at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's giving a recital with some colleagues tomorrow night, and we'll hear him play some solo and hear some other things that will be on his program and a bit about tuba playing generally. First, though, I'll be talking with Brad Holmes, who is a director of choral activities at Millikan University in Decatur, the, I think we can truly say, famed Millikan University Choir. Has been on a tour, and they are just back and actually headed out for another brief stint, and will give a tour-ending concert Sunday afternoon in Decatur. We'll hear all about it, and some wonderful music, including this by John Rutter. It's music by John Rutter, a choral fanfare it's called, by the Millikan University Choir under the direction of Brad Holmes. It comes from a CD a few years ago they released called Hearts All Whole. And the Millikan Choir has been on a bit of a tour. They're giving a winter tour finale concert this coming Sunday at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Decatur at 4 o'clock, and it's free. Can't beat that. Brad Holmes, my guest, this portion of Live and Local. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to talk to you, Kevin.
So where's the tour taking you?
You know, it's been kind of Midwestern in circumference. We've gone as far east as Cincinnati and down to Louisville, St. Louis, up into Wisconsin, into Chicago. So kind of a circle around the area here.
And has this pretty much been what the choir typically does on a winter break?
Yeah, we're out very often for a couple of weeks annually. I don't mean very often, but every year we're out for a couple of weeks. And we try to stay close to home, farm our own territory a little bit with the good name of Millikan, and do what we can to let people know what we're doing. But then usually a couple years out of three, we're stretching a little further afield. But I like the local tours. People know who we are a little bit more maybe, and concert attendance was just fantastic this year. So.
When you say sometimes you go a little farther afield, that has sometimes included quite a bit farther afield, Scandinavia, Russia, Haiti, elsewhere?
Yeah, well, in fact, in this summer, we'll tour the Baltic countries of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. So in the summers, we'll have a chance to get out internationally a little bit every third year or so. So I'm excited about that because I've never been to those places.
What's in it for the choir and the university when the choir does both a relatively local tour and especially, I guess, an international tour?
Well, I think it's probably better for the university when we're out here fairly locally, letting people know what we're doing musically. Music is a real flagship of Millikan, and so we're very proud of that. And so just reminding people of the quality that we have in kind of the, I mean, it's really a recruiting tour in some senses. We like students to see what we're doing, and hopefully they'll join us. The international things are really more for our students. I think they experience all those great things that you experience when you go, and you will sing with some other choirs over there and kind of get a little broader view of the world, and that's just kind of gravy for the student's education, I think.
You're actually this week, starting tomorrow, going to be singing at the Illinois Music Educators Association. Is that their annual conference?
Right, their annual conference. We'll have the good opportunity to sing there briefly and let, you know, show people Millikan's work. And that's always great fun because there's a lot of high school directors there. So we love that. A lot of our own students are conducting high schools in the state. So it's a little bit of old home week too.
The university choir is one of five main choral ensembles at the university at Millikan, and it involves sort of a really high percentage of students at the university overall. What are the special requirements of getting into this particular choir, and then also what's the mission, so to speak, of this choir separate from the other ones?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our mission is to lead be the flagship, to lead the charge. That I don't know whether it's different than the other ones as much as it's we like to see the students come up kind of through the ranks. I have a lot of students that sing with me that have sung in three other choirs over their time, and so that's just a great development of their abilities and their talents, and the demands on us are a little bit more extensive than they would be on the younger choirs, and so it really is, it's the same mission, maybe just taken to the next level, we hope.
So is it do the kids who want to be in this choir have to audition to get into it, or do you just monitor them through their progress in the other ensembles?
You know, we re-audition every year, and so students are always auditioning up through the ranks, and so some you know get into a different choir every year. Some will stay at a particular level. Some of our better ones will make it all the way to the top early. So it's a re-audition process every year. It's very competitive and demanding. So students have to really want it.
Talk a little bit about your approach to selecting music for the group. We opened with this quite a lively piece by a contemporary English composer, John Rutter, who has written a ton of choral music.
Right.
A choral fanfare. We're going to hear a couple of things quite different from that coming up in a minute.
Well, I'm always after a breadth of kinds of approaches to singing, so I certainly am going to touch historical sources. We'll do something, a lot of historical things, but I also find there's a real difference in kinds of singing geographically, and so as we go from music of Western Europe to maybe more Eastern Europe kinds of sounds, that's a really intriguing sound. The Swedish kinds of sounds or the Scandinavian sounds, very often a very different approach, and the music asks for that. So I'm looking for kinds of geographic and historical slots in my program to keep it varied. Choral tone that changes is kind of one of our soapboxes, and so we're always hunting for something different. sound-wise. So.
Well, here's something completely different from what we heard, and it certainly is comes under the historical, I guess. Idumea, is that how you say this early American hymn name?
Well, you know, I don't know how to say it. People seem to say Idumea, I've heard quite frequently. I don't know what the right, what's the real word, but it's a biblical reference, and yeah, that's an early American kind of approach, and we take a very rough kind of vocal quality towards it.
It sounds like, there's different terms for this type of singing, shape note singing,
yes.
Sacred harp singing.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And does it? Well, let's let people listen, and then I'll ask a follow-up question. However you say the name of this early American hymn, it's an arrangement by Rick Biela. Is that how he says?
Biela.
Okay. There's solo violin opening, solo voice, and then gradually the choir comes in. It's the Millick University Choir under the direction of Brad Holmes, my guest here on Live and Local. Idumea, let's say, is the name of that early American hymn. Sometimes, as Brad Holmes said, they're named after biblical places. Sometimes they're named after geographical places in New England.
Right.
That an arrangement by Rick Biela, sorry, and performed by at least one instrumentalist and members of the Milk University Choir. They're going to be singing Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the end of their winter tour, St. Patrick Catholic Church. That type of really raw, straight-tone singing, does that hurt them at all?
Well, you know, it can if they're ignorant of what their voice is doing. It certainly probably can get into their voice in a negative way. You listen to shape note singers, and you just wonder how they go at it all day long. Sometimes, where the watchword is louder is better. They're so strident in their singing, and yet they keep going. But we work pretty hard at finding ways to get at that sound without damaging the vocal mechanism, and talk a lot about that. So it's a good question.
Do you personally have background as a singer?
I do.
So you're able to speak to that pretty authoritatively when you say this technically is what you would do to keep from hurting yourself.
Well, for the most part, I can speak out of my own experience when I did get myself into trouble, and they really have to go back to their studio teaching, to their back, you know, to their training, to what their voice teacher is trying to do with them in creating a freedom and that kind of thing. But mostly we get to the sounds through varied placement and varied vowel color. It may sound kind of strident, but for the most part, we get at these kind of sounds by placement and resonance. And a lot of times my voice teachers say, wow, you opened up some things in that voice that we've been trying to get, but they thought it was kind of an ugly sound, so they're unwilling to go there, and you've created some new possibilities. So we get along pretty well.
Let's do one more song, and this one I guess speaks to the international part of it, assuming it's a guy, international. Do I say this name correctly, Vytautas Miškinis or
yeah,
something
Miškinis
like that?
Yeah, Miškinis is a Lithuanian composer. Mm-hmm. In fact, we'll visit his hometown when we go on. He's from Vilnius, and very, very well appreciated. Lots of new music coming out from him. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
Lucis Creator Optime. What does that mean? And then talk about your approach to sound with this kind of music.
Well, it's a creator of light, and this these kinds of chord structures are so narrow that a very direct approach to intonation and pitch really drives the piece, and you'll hear pretty thick harmonic structures. So you can't be sharing your pitch with somebody else. You have to be spot on and accurate. So that's really the very bright and forward and direct approach to the sound.
Sometime it would be a blast to actually sit in on one of your rehearsals and see how you go at some of this stuff, because the choir sounds so magnificent.
I appreciate it. We'd love to have you. Come on.
It's the Milken University Choir, director Brad Holmes, and they're giving their winter tour finale concert Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Decatur. I guess I said 4 o'clock. It's free, or you can donate to the free will offering that they're happy to take. Lucis Creator Optime by Vytautas Miškinis, Milken University Choir on Live and Local. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks very much.
That's music by Vitaldas Miškinas, Lucis Creator Optime, sung by the Millikan University Choir under the direction of Brad Holmes, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. They're, again, giving their end-of-tour concert Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock, St. Patrick Catholic Church in Decatur. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. Stay tuned for a conversation with University of Illinois faculty tubist Mark Moore in advance of his recital tomorrow night. That's music by Carlos Gardel, Por Una Cabeza, in a performance by accordionist William Schimmel, pianist Michael Saul, and violinist Stan Curtis here on Live and Local. That's actually music that will be played on a recital tomorrow night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, starts at 7:30 by University of Illinois faculty tubist Mark Moore and one of his colleagues. So you have to now imagine how that might sound for tuba and trombone.
I think tuba and euphonium.
And euphonium. The trombone faculty member at the university is Elliot Chazanoff, and often, if not usually, either the tubist on faculty or the trombonist on faculty will also teach euphonium. How does it go
I
here?
Teach the euphonium.
You teach euphonium.
And Elliot, I've been colleagues for, 23 years? And I asked him to play with me. We had done some Baroque duets about 15 years ago, and that's what I had in mind. And he said, oh, by the way, I just got this new copy of these Gardel tangos arranged for two cellos. How about if I arrange them for tuba and euphonium? He just bought a euphonium last semester that's just the same brand as my tuba. So we wanted to have matching horns.
How convenient.
So we rehearsed for the last 2 days, and they're fantastic.
Did he buy that? Knowing what you had and with the idea that you'd play together, or just coincidental?
Yeah, he loves this horn. It's a Hirschbrenner tuba made in Switzerland. So he bought the euphonium that they make. And, you know, he's had several different brands of euphoniums, but he's always wanted this one. He found it cheap on eBay, so he bought it.
So. It should be obvious by now that this is Mark Moore, known to his friends as Mickey.
That's right.
Who is... who's in the studio with us. And he does have his tuba. We're going to hear him play some Baroque music coming up live, as well as talk about quite an interesting variety of music from various sources that that are on the recital program. Since we talked about the euphonium, a lot of people probably don't even know what that instrument is.
The euphonium and the tuba are in the same family. The euphonium, a lot of people think it's a baritone, but the baritone is a different board instrument. The euphonium players like to say, yes, I play the euphonium, I don't play the baritone. But it's basically the tuba and the euphonium are just two instruments in the same voice, just an octave apart.
For those who out there who maybe have played in bands and have probably heard the term baritone more often,
right?
What's the difference between that one and the euphonium? Besides the
baritone has a different bore. It's a much smaller bore than the euphonium. The euphonium has a larger bore, which is the diameter of the tubing. It makes a huge difference in the sound. In the British brass band, they will use both. They'll have two baritones and two euphoniums, and they make quite a bit different sound.
So the baritone's probably going to be a little narrower sound?
A little brighter sounding. Brighter. Actually, Percy Grainger, the Australian composer, would write arrangements and have baritones and euphonium parts in all his arrangements. He always gave the solos to the baritone part, but nowadays usually the euphonium players play those solos because they like the solos.
Is the euphonium somehow the elite of the two instruments, or is that a silly thing to say?
I don't think that the euphonium players would say it's the elite. It's just that's what we play. It's a tradition in the last, 50 years.
Since you mentioned also that Elliott had these Carlos Gardel tangos arranged for cellos, that suggests that much of the music for tuba wasn't written for tuba.
Well, I mean, you can play full concerts of stuff written just for the instrument, but I don't like to.
Why is that?
Well, I love other music. I will try to play a Baroque piece on a recital. I love songs. So I have, I think, three sets of Mahler Lieder that I like to do, at least two sets of Brahms songs. I've done Strauss songs, Boris Godunov songs from Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov. And it's just very good to play other literature. I've stolen Baroque oboe concertos and Baroque flute concertos.
Really?
So... If it's good and I think it can sound good, then I'm going to steal it.
Well, how would you decide that a flute or oboe piece, which of course is the two highest members of the wind family anyway, woodwind family, might actually sound good in the tuba? Is it you decide you like the tune and then mess around with the tuba and see?
Well, actually, about 30 years ago, I was teaching at the University of South Mississippi. And our flute teacher played the Bach E-flat flute sonata. And the second movement just breaks your heart. It's so good. And I said, I have to play that. So I borrowed it from her, and I arranged it for the tuba. And I had to practice really hard in the outside movement so I could play that middle one in the middle. But I just absolutely love it. And I did the same thing with a Marcello oboe concerto. And then I got told by an oboe player, well, you played it in the wrong key. Well, that was the key that I found it in. And they say, well, it's in this key or it's in that key. I don't care. Same thing with the songs. Usually a leader will be arranged in for a high voice or low voice. I'll get both of the copies and see which one works best for me on my tuba.
Well, and there's a whole music history's worth of tradition of people changing keys of pieces to accommodate another instrument.
Right.
Or even, if you're a singer, to accommodate a different singer.
Yes.
Even though it might be one soprano or another soprano, maybe such said soprano can't sing as high as the first one, and so you bring it down to, people have to arrange entire orchestra parts to accommodate singers all the time, especially music theater, I think.
Yeah. Well, I remember it was a long, long time ago, but Birgit Nielsen, the famous Wagnerian soprano, came here and gave a recital in the 70s. And she was accompanied by John Woosman, one of our former colleagues on the faculty. And at the end of the concert, people were shouting requests for encores from the audience. She would turn to John and say, we'll play this one, we'll sing this one, you play it in this key. And then he would just start. And I was blown away and just said, oh, yeah.
So that he could actually...
He could play whatever song she wanted and whatever key she wanted. It was just wonderful. And I think she sang like 6 or 8 encores. It was an absolutely incredible concert.
One of the pieces, I should really say three of the pieces that are on your program tomorrow night are, in fact, arrangements of songs, three of what are known as the four serious songs by Johannes Brahms.
Yes.
Let's listen to one of those. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I have the first one.
Okay.
Queued up here, Denn es geht dem Menschen, and I'll give the text coming up, but it's sung here by a marvelous bass baritone from years gone by, Hans Hotter, with pianist Gerald Moore. Music by Johannes Brahms, sung by Hans Hotter, the first of the four serious songs, the text of which, as you would expect, is pretty serious. It comes from, in the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, and part of the text goes, "For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all turn to dust again." And there's about another half of the text that continues. Gerald Moore was the pianist. That's the first of three of those serious songs that tubist Mark Moore will play on his recital, the Kranert Center in Urbana, tomorrow night. And I guess a couple of questions for you, Mickey. One is, what do you take from the voice? Because you told me actually before we started to this segment on the show that you'd actually rather that I played a vocal version of that, vocal original, rather than a tuba player playing it, because that's what you learn from more.
Well, I mean, it's always trying to imitate the human voice. It's all about the song. And actually, one of my teachers, Arnold Jacobs in the Chicago Symphony, always talked about listen to the song, make the song. So I'm always trying to imitate the singers. I've even had some good voice colleagues tell me they're trying to imitate the instrumentalists with the accuracy of the pitch and everything else like that. But it's like, it's just, you try to imitate the sound of the voice because it's such a beautiful sound.
And is that a matter of tone? Is it a matter of expression? Is it a matter of a specific singer? You know, like if you listen to Hans Hotter, for example.
Yes, all of that. But one of my first recordings I ever listened to when I first started teaching was Leontine Price singing. And I just fell in love with it. And I said, I've got to do this song. I've got to do this one. I've got to do this one. And one of them was a Strauss song called Morning. And it took me like 15 years to find a pianist who would agree to play that with me.
Because it's difficult?
Or no, it's not hard at all.
They refused to play with a tubist.
They didn't think I could do anything that a soprano would be doing. But, you know, it's all music. And if it's good, then I want it. And, it, you know, and I'm going to play it.
This might be putting you completely on the spot because you didn't come prepared to play that. But are you able to play just a little part of that that we just heard, opening?
Yes, I am.
He's going to, because I'm just curious to hear. You know, let our listeners hear what happens when you go from voice to tuba. Of course, we don't have a piano.
Yeah.
Well, we have a piano. We don't have a pianist with us right at the moment.
And also, I have two different tubas that I play on. I'm going to play this one on my bigger C tuba instead, and I have my F tuba here in the studio. But
so this is like the baritone tuba, not the instrument baritone, but the voice register, and the other is like the real bass tuba.
Yeah, and you know, my students will ask me, how do I choose which instrument I'm going to play these pieces on? And I said, the music tells me. When I did the Brahms, I said, this is going to be on my C tuba. I have a Mahler set that I do all on my F tuba. And it doesn't matter to me. The song tells me what it wants to be on, and that's what I do. But I have practiced this piece, actually, on my F tuba when I was off visiting my brother over the Christmas vacation and had only this horn with me. I practiced the Brahms because I wanted to practice the Brahms.
Good for us, then.
You know.
Well, let's hear what it sounds like at the beginning.
The first phrase.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sound. Do you study the text?
Yes. I read the text. I sit there and say, okay, what kind of mood should I be in? I've even tried to make sure that I take the breaths where the commas are. Mm. And I don't know, you remember Eric Dahlheim, another one of my colleagues who was on the accompanying faculty. I was playing a Mahler set with him one time, and I was having a real difficult time making the text and making it to the comma. And Eric says, stop, wait. He says, breathe right here. The singers can't make it that far either. And I went, oh, thank goodness. I thought it was just me.
Yeah.
So I try to make it fit. I try to make the phrases where the commas are in the text, but sometimes you have to breathe.
So you go so far as to write the text into your part?
I'm following on the score. I always do that. I've had students who just take it and transcribe the part and put it in bass clef and just have the notes. I have the real piano score, and I just read it.
So what you were playing right now was actually the bass voice,
or
whoever can. I don't know. I don't.
No, this is
know.
The solo voice. It's in treble clef. Voice. I just played down a couple octaves.
Okay, Mickey Moore, Mark Moore is my guest. This portion of Live and Local here on FM 90.9. He's giving a recital tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, and. So we mentioned Elliot Chazanoff, your colleague, trombone playing, in this case euphonium playing colleague, who's going to be joining you. Who else is on the program with you?
The accompanist is one of the graduate students who's been assigned to my studio, and she's done such a great job this fall that I asked her to play for me. Her name is Han Ah Choi, and she's from Korea. She started her master's here, and now she's in the doctoral program. She's a student of Tim Ahlens. And she's a fantastic pianist, so I said, will you play with me? And
yeah, sure.
She's very happy to do it. She's doing a great job.
You know, I have known some pianists who perform with various instrumentalists or singers And there are some who seem to actually specialize, to a point anyway, in the repertoire of, say, a specific instrument. There was somebody, I recall, and I can't remember if it was here or back at Northwestern when I was a student ages ago, who specialized in the trumpet literature as a pianist. Does that tend to be, have you found pianists who will do that with tuba literature, or is that too limiting for them?
Well, actually, at the tuba conferences that we have, like every 2 years, they have an international conference, and every other year they have regional conferences. And there's some pianists who know all the literature and get called upon quite often. They might be spouses of tuba players. One of the best ones that I know is Barbara Young, who's the wife of Jerry Young, who was the tuba teacher at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who got his doctorate here at the University of Illinois. And she's fantastic. So, you know, she knows pretty much all the tuba literature. But, you know, one of my pianists that I used for years, her husband was a trumpet colleague of mine. And she knows all the tuba literature. She played, her husband used to teach her at the University of Illinois, and she played for my predecessor, Fritz Kinzig, who's now in Michigan. So, you know, people get specialized, but, you know, they can do it all.
And even if they do it all, if they learn, as you said, most of the repertoire for an instrument, they're probably going to be in demand at least for that instrument, plus everything else.
As a matter of fact, my friend Mimi, who's on the faculty at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky, she's about the only person that I'd play the Hindemith Sonata with.
Really?
Because she's not afraid of it.
Paul Hindemith has written a sonata for literally every instrument, and then probably concerto for each of them as well, and they tend to be often pretty difficult, especially for the pianist.
Yes, the piano part is just deadly.
The solo instrument, ironically, is usually a piece of cake in comparison, although you're often plenty difficult in within the realm of that instrument. You brought along some music to play that is not on your recital tomorrow night, but it comes under that category of music not originally written for the tuba that you borrowed. Talk about that a little bit before we actually play it.
I don't mind the word stolen.
Stolen, that's fine. Borrowed, stolen.
Actually, when I was in graduate school, I took a counterpoint class, and the teacher was incredible, and we spent at least 80% of the semester on the Bach Well-Tempered Clavier. And I absolutely fell in love with Bach, and I've been in love with Bach my whole life ever since. And so many, many years ago, I found the A minor flute partita, and it's been arranged and put in bass clef. And I said, okay, I'm going to play that piece because I absolutely loved it. So I did it many, many years ago, and it's just been a friend of mine ever since. And so I just said, okay, I'm going to play two movements of the Bach A minor flute partita. I'm going to play the Sarabande and the English Bourée.
Both of those forms of dance forms.
Right.
And all those partitas and such have those kinds of titles to them. Mickey Moore, Mark Moore, my guest live in our studio on Live and Local. Mm-hmm. Pretty athletic.
Oh, it's so fun. It's so fun.
I remember when I used to play French horn, which is a long, long time ago now, that among the things I enjoyed playing were some of the faster dance movements from the Bach cello suites, which have been arranged for a lot of different instruments. And but at the same time, I really hated trying to play the slower movements, like the first one you did, because they tend to leap around enormously, the Bourré did for you as well, which is something that's rather easier to do on a cello, say, than a horn or a tuba. Can you say the same thing about shifting from the flute to the tuba?
I mean, you've never
played the flute, so...
Well,
I assume,
you know, I have lots of friends and colleagues who play the woodwinds. And, you know, it always seems like, because one of my dear friends was a bassoonist who's now in the Boston Symphony. And he and I'd look at his music and it's all scales and it's all fast notes. And I go, that's really hard. And then he'd look at my music and it's all jumps all over the place. He goes, no, that's really hard. So I think it's a matter of what we get used to. There's so much that we can do as brasses with just our lips and not have to worry about what the fingers are doing because it's all done with the lips. And that's really fairly easy for us, you know, where the fast passage with the fingers moving really fast is like, you know, for me to move my vowels takes a lot more muscle than it does to just flick the keys on a woodwind instrument. But if I want to steal that music, then I've got to do it. So I'll practice as much as I have to so that I can steal it, you know.
And just so folks know, if you're interested in this, the tuba that you're playing here has four what you call piston valves. They're
right.
Like a trumpet. You push them up and down. And then what does it have? One
rotary valve. It has one rotary valve. That valve is just to extend the range. You can't get all the way down to the fundamental of the instrument with just four valves because of the length of the instrument. On trumpets, what they do with their three valves is they push slides to make pitch fixes.
Mm-hmm.
And the slide would have to be pushed so far on a tuba that you would never be able to do it. So I have a fourth valve, which is the same as a one and three combination, but built longer. And then the fifth valve is another combination. So with the combination of those five valves, I can get chromatically down to the fundamental of the pitch of the instrument.
Although I have seen tuba players manipulating a slide
for
pitch sometimes. I guess that depends which instrument you're playing.
Yeah, it depends on the instrument. One of my tubas, yes, I have to move some slides sometimes to get the pitches correct, and that's called life. I love the sound of the instrument, so I will worry about the slides.
Well, and that's one of the things that's different, too, about brass playing. You only have three or four keys or pistons.
Right.
Whereas a woodwind instrument, you have many more combinations of a lot more keys, so you can be a little bit more precise, I suppose, have more dedicated fingerings to particular notes, whereas this, it's all on the lips. to change the pitches just within such a small number of combinations of the valve.
But, you know, at least for us, now, for flute, it's a different story, but for the reed instruments, I've had so many friends who walk off the stage at the end of the concert and just take the reed and break it because they hate the reed. And, you know, they're at the mercy of a piece of wood that was grown in the south of France like two or three years ago. I don't even know how long they take them to get them aged. But with me, if there's something wrong, it's my lips and I can fix it in that moment. And it's not at the mercy of a piece of wood, you know, so I feel as a brass player, you know, I have more freedom because if there's something going wrong, I know how to fix it.
Well, because it's within you, probably.
Yeah.
You know, the instrument is metal. It doesn't change
much. It doesn't change. I've changed the fingerings on one of my tubas at least four times in the last 25 years. The metal didn't change, but the lips changed.
The lips change, yeah, as things move on.
Hopefully the lips get better. Yeah. The lips get smarter.
Mark Moore is my guest on Live and Local. He's giving a recital at the Krannert Center in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois tomorrow night at 7:30. We'll go out in a moment with a portion of one of the big pieces, so to speak, that he's playing on that concert. Let me mention a few other events going on tonight anyway. Gloria Rubel and Paul Sabuco are at Clark Bar in Champaign this evening at 6:30. The Moscow Festival Ballet is presenting Giselle at the Krannert Center at 7 o'clock. The SSG Trio play jazz at the Iron Post in Urbana this evening at 5:30, so coming up very shortly. And then they will join others of their jazz faculty at 8 o'clock, also at the Iron Post. And there's a carillon concert in Washington Park in Springfield, the Thomas Reese Memorial Carillon. That is at 7 o'clock. They do one tomorrow night as well. And finally, violinist Sarah Sasaki will give a recital at the Urbana Free Library tonight at 7:30. Hope you'll join us again for another show tomorrow at 4 o'clock. I'll be talking with Wayne Hancock, a country singer, among others, on tomorrow's show. And pleased to have your company for that. On the next Community Cinema, you can join Illinois Public Media at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus for This one is an incomplete announcement, so skip that. But I will say that programs today are made possible with the support of the Friends of WILL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. This is 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Mickey, thanks very much for joining us on the show, and have a lot of fun tomorrow night.
Thank you very much.
Here's another tubist, Patrick Sheridan, who is joined here by Johann Willem Friso Military Band in the opening movement of Rolf Wilhelm's tuba concertino. That piece will actually open tomorrow night's concert from Mark Moore. The